Well, hello again there, folks. So I'm on a break. I am now standing in the Republic of Ireland on the west coast. The west coast of Ireland at the end of February. And I have to say, it's just absolutely spectacularly beautiful. This is my country, Northumberland, Scotland, and this the west coast of Ireland here. It's the first time I've ever been here. I've travelled in the last day or two. I've travelled through Northern Ireland. Now we're into the Republic, and I mean, look, just you talk about these kind of misty, gloomy looking hills. This is it. I mean, this is literally what we're looking at here. And I do feel it is just such a poetic place. And Mrs. Morgoth was saying that we were talking about what the difference is between the north and the south. Is there any differences? And she was saying that there seems to be a sort of sadness that hangs over the Republic. And I think she's right, which is so. I mean, I'm certainly not going to make commentary on all of the political problems, you know, with the north and the south. But I think I can see what she means. There's it's probably the influence of the British, the British mainland, the London, and England in particular. I think, and I've said it before, that in England there's this. You sort of feel like you're in this hub of hub of activity, like you're in an engine room of a big machine. And I think here you realise there's a different way of seeing things and different way of being. And I understand that, but the problem is it's hard to quantify because it's not materialistic. All of the landscape, what surprised me is that the landscape is just dotted with these little cottages, little houses squirreled away. And then, I mean, that hill in the background there was prominent in Game of Thrones. It popped up a few times. But I think what's interesting when you look at the political situation in Ireland is like everywhere else, it's soul. There's a war over its soul, a war which seems to have been lost in England a long time ago. But in Ireland, you see it. And what is it? It's the struggle between what you can quantify and reduce to numbers on a spreadsheet, including the people themselves, to a more whimsical and a more poetic soul. This kind of soul that will meditate on misty covered hills, and write poetry and write music and explore what it is to be human, what it is to be in your own place in the world. I'm gonna head off now, and we're gonna go further down, and hopefully I'll be able to make a bit of a travel log for you all. But what a start. I mean, just stunning, absolutely beautiful place to be in the world. So just to pick up on what I was saying about globalism, I mean, look at that sunset. I'm from the northeast, so I don't get to see a sunset like that very often. You've got to be down at the on the coast to watch the sun rise, and here you get it set, which is kind of, you know, I don't want to be too depressing because I'm not really in a depressed mood because it's a beautiful place to be. But that's kind of the island seems to be on the front line of the current war. It's not just a culture war. It's something much more profound than that, I think. And when you look at this, when you look at this sunset here, and you look at the mountains, and it isn't touristy. I know there's a lot of touristy areas, but this isn't. And the problem that we have is, how do you quantify this? How do you, in a world that's run by spreadsheets and data, where everything is abstract, everything is a computer model, including the people who are set to come in. And you can see in a way that if you do just have a brain, a sadistic, twisted brain of numbers, and sort of instrumental reason, there's not really any way to appreciate the beauty of this in and of itself. On a much smaller scale, I've sort of involved myself with a local issue back home. And I've brought this up with planners and local councillors, this issue that you can't just protect something for the sake of its own beauty. There's nothing efficient about this. In a way, to go across Ireland, I think this is one of the big differences that I've seen with Ireland and England, is that England seems to be perfectly designed to be efficient, to be this engine of progress and industry and economics and this outward growth and expansion, whereas with Ireland it's something, and that's what I alluded to before about the sadness or the melancholy that hangs on it, that there's a sort of stillness and a sort of inward looking, which is to say that when you look at the current, I mean, as I'm recording this, there's protests going on around the country against mass immigration, which it'll be framed as being against these other people, these foreigners. But what the root of that is the sort of the idea of just being left on your own land, the idea of not being disturbed by modernity, which Ireland is, sort of being kicking and stream, dragged into the grid, which is, and this time it isn't the English doing it, it's other forces at play. But I don't, you know, you come to a place like this and you just wouldn't know that was all going on in the background, and you think some of these places that I've seen, it just seems so little cottages dotted around, pretty much self-sufficient, and you think, yeah, this is the problem. This isn't on this kind of, not just the digital grid, but the energy grid, even just, but I think deeper than that, even more, is the psychological and the spiritual grid. That's the thing. That's what the current unrest is, and the current tension in Ireland, I think. But yeah, absolutely beautiful, absolutely spectacular. I'll catch you later. I'll catch you on my next little travel log, which I'll probably lump them all together for one big one. So I should really end it by saying, let's see what pops up along the way. I'm going to try and do some upbeat ones as well, despite myself. Not going to lie, like, folks, this alone was worth a visit. For once, I'm actually lost for words. Absolutely stunning. Like, I stare at this all day. Okay, so now that I'm catching my breath, I'm taking it all in. Pretty spectacular. It goes all the way, like, I think it's literally called a horseshoe. I should have done more research on it, but I've been plottering, getting around from A to B so quickly I haven't had a chance. So this is WB Yeats Company, country. It's his local. We passed on the way. There's a Yeats trail around here. I was looking at this stunning. I mean, it's huge in real, in the flesh. Like, I don't think I'm going to get up on there today, if I'm honest. But I'm going to give it a go. Like. But I mentioned in another little short that I did about Game of Thrones, because I think some of Game of Thrones was filmed around this area. Ben Bulden, I think it is. I'm gonna get massacred in the comments for butchering all of these words. But the funny thing about that is that there is this kind of sort of postmodern take that goes around where you see objects of natural beauty like that, like this whole sort of mythological landscape that I'm in, and you immediately compare it to fictional that you've seen. It reminds me of Game of Thrones. It reminds me of Skyrim. And so your sort of frame of reference for what you're looking at in the real world is clouded. You're looking at it through a sort of postmodern lens. And I've been grappling with that as I've been sort of panting my guts out on the way up this mountain, this hill here. I actually think it's a bit of a cope. I think it's an urbanite cope. I didn't. None of that passed my mind at all. Well, it did from a distance, but now that I'm kind of here and I'm up close and I'm really like in it, it isn't like that at all. I'm not really thinking of these things other than to critique the idea that we like that's a thing. Which you could say like that in of itself is like the trap. You're trapped. Either you're comparing the natural world, so you're seeing it through a lens of pop culture and these references instead of seeing it for what it really is, or you're viewing it with an eye on critiquing the reference to pop culture. And you can kind of tie yourself in mental knots like that. But I don't see it that way. There's something more to it than that. There's something, what I've been thinking about is how much time I've pissed away on social media and how much time I've been thinking precisely in those terms that I was just, that labyrinth, which you can just kind of step over it all and return to like an authenticity, which a landscape like that seems to do. Certainly physically, it's kicking all of that mumbo jumbo out of your mind as you're trying to work your way up the hillside of it. You've got to work, you've got to earn this, which is another thing that it isn't the case that, everything is just better. Like, we can get a hyper-real version of this, which is this, but exaggerated. It's this, but it slightly tweaked. I mean, I've got no filters on the phone here whatsoever. I've never seen anything on a screen that can compare with this. Just the entire experience of it, of being in this landscape. It isn't just, it's like this form of fiction. No, it's something, it's entirely of a different magnitude and a different order to be actually in a landscape like this. And I find all of those urbanite copes, they kind of evaporate in the face of actual authentic reality and being in a place like this, which, you know, you got to be thankful that places like this exist. You really do. Because it makes you human again. I think that's what I'm trying to get at on this unscripted ramble where I've been panting my guts out for the last half hour. I'm going to see what's up ahead. Another thing that I've noticed about this landscape is that it makes you feel small. It makes you feel humble. And to get back to the point of the sort of being in a postmodern frame as opposed to this, like this monolithic, ancient, imposing landscape. You may, at the end of the day, the kind of impression is that you're not much more than an ant. Like, it's almost this Lovecraftian cosmicism where you don't, like, your neuroses, your anxieties, your ego, all of the bullshit that you're wrapped up in your daily routine, none of it matters. None of it matters whatsoever. It's completely irrelevant and you don't care. And if you've got that as a kind of permanent reminder and a permanent backdrop to your normal life, which we don't, in modernity, in sat behind our screens, obsessing about who's liking our tweets, who is our friend at work, all this nonsense, it kind of brings to the fore, like, which one is the reality? Which one is real? Is it the petty bullshit of our daily lives, which puts ourselves at the center of everything, or is it this ancient monolithic landscape, this unchanging eternity? Because it's something that we like to kind of keep out of our minds because it brings this sort of existential angst up. So we can cope and escape into absurdities and stupidities of the modern world so that we don't have to confront our own smallness. And this isn't to say that a sort of new atheist kind of cringe thing, you know, but we're a speck of dust in the universe. quite the opposite, because it begins to it puts you in a more healthy place to think in more spiritual terms, to think to at least think about grander things than the petty bullshit, who's just retweeted you, or who sent you the last text message, or how many notifications you've got, and all this rubbish. It's just splendid. It's absolutely wonderful. I'm gonna try and get up on the top. Good luck with that. I'm gonna give it a go. Like an old war horse, I am. It was an old song back in the 60s, and I forgot the name of the song now. You take paradise and you put up a parking lot. And it was the song had a left wing sentiment. And you think it rings true today, you know? Like, if you take paradise and you just reduce it to a load of shit, to a boring concrete car park. And is that the argument, the pro-global homo argument against Ireland? Is that this is going to be improved with more Amazon warehouses, more diversity, more political correctness, more NGOs, more speech, more thought crimes, more control, more concrete, more housing blocks? Yeah, fuck off, man. Lord. It's disgusting. It's like a parasitic force. Well, folks, I'm here in Belfast. I hope you can hear us over all the traffic in the background. It was a lot more peaceful in the mountains. But I just thought this was an interesting thing to have a look at. Look, check out this Chad. Check out this this world conqueror. And you go down and you see that the Burma, Constantinople and Egypt. And then on this side, you see that there's a Sikh as representative of India, and on this side you have a Canadian frontiersman, and the title says, "To the illustrious memory of Frederick Temple, first Marquis of Dufferin and Ava," I can't make that out, "Governor General of Canada, Viceroy of India, Ambassador at St. Petersburg, Constantinople, Rome and Paris, Lieutenant of the County of Down and Freeman of the City of Belfast. This memorial of a great Irishman is erected by his countrymen and his many friends throughout the world." So here, this fella here is sort of the empire at work, the absolute embodiment of empire as an Irishman. Presumably, you know, the Irish didn't have much of an empire, but it would have been the British Empire. And of course, this is where the problems start, isn't it? This is where you run into the what Belfast has become synonymous with is the friction between the Irish Republic and the British Empire. And here on the other side of Belfast City Hall, you see Queen Victoria herself, the figurehead of empire, with the grandiosity and the pomp and the ceremony of empire itself be standing right behind her. Of course, this isn't in London. It's on the island of Ireland. It's in Northern Ireland, and this is, as I say, this is where all the problems begin. But if I'm honest, it's more of a problem and a paradox for the English, because where how do you wire this up? How do you wire up the empire and these subservient subjects at the feet of the Empress of India? And at the same time say that you just want to be a little shireling left alone on your, you know, on the south coast of England or whatever. it's difficult to wire that up, you know, and there's been a lot of discussion about it. Because at least for the Irish, it's we just want to be left alone, get out of our country. For the English, on the one hand, and I'm not going to lie, that it, just in terms of national pride, when you look at the scale of the building, look at the majesty of it all. There's a deeply sort of right-wing supremacist attitude to that. It is elitist, very much so, but it stands at complete odds with the sentiment of the Shireling, who finds it all quite ridiculous, and they just want to go back to their farm. I mean, a lot of people from Northern Ireland would rather the last statue is representative of all the people of Northern Ireland who were thrown into the front lines of Britannia's wars. They went along for the ride, as did the Welsh and the Scots. they're down for this as well. But look at it. Look at the greatness of it. How can you not at least admire the greatness of it all? Well, folks, I've come down to the Titanic Museum, and I don't know what to make of this building. Like, I really don't. Is this an iceberg? Have they turned the Titanic Museum into an iceberg? A giant monolithic iceberg? Is that not an... That seems like poor taste to me. Titanic, of course, another the celebration of Belfast shipbuilders. I think it deserves a better sound off than to gloat like this, if that's what it is. So you often see these kind of images, this juxtaposition, when you see like the old kind of buildings, the old style of architectures, juxtaposed to the new, which is all just a kind of monolithic glass, neoliberal nothingness. And the funny thing about the trip to Belfast and throughout Ireland, I think, is this one of the things that we've have to get to grips with on all sides of this is identity. The English identity with the empire versus the English identity of home and hearth versus the Northern Irish identity and its relationship to England versus the people of the Republic's identity, and how they are currently trying to get to grips with this. And what I think is so interesting, and when you see these images, that you often see images like this on the internet, which are spliced together, and it's as if to say, look how crap everything is now. But I think the older buildings, they represent identity, and the new one represents an absence of it. In fact, it's deliberately designed not to have any kind of prior identities. It's deliberately designed for people from nowhere. And this is actually what we're all facing, regardless of our own sort of the bloody history and how all and intertwined it all is and the various paradoxes. The future is the monolith. The future is the great abyss and nothingness of the globality, which is going to erase all identities. It's purposefully designed to do it. That's and so in a way, the older buildings in this scene here, they represent the old blood feuds, you know, the old baggage of history, whereas the new monolith is, in a way, it's a sort of clearing the way. It's an absence, complete absence, and the final liberation of the promise, the conclusion to the promise of liberalism is to liberate you from your identity, from everything. So you end up as just a complete blank slate, automaton.